We are fascinated with marriage. You can see it through our legal system. You can see it through our media consumption. And even in our obsession with the royal wedding, we see the blissful photos of a beaming Prince Harry who will tie the knot with American actress Meghan Markle. And about a week from now, there's countdown clocks out there. The last royal wedding between Prince William and Kate Middleton in 2011 was watched by an estimated 3 billion people worldwide, including 23 million viewers here on this side of the pond. You are with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new book is Wife, Inc., The Business of Marriage in the 21st Century. Suzanne Leonard is an associate professor of English at Simmons College there in Boston. Suzanne, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here this morning.
So early on in your book, you write that American marriage culture has been radically re-envisioned in the 21st century. That's a big loaded sentence there. Can you give us more, and we'll dig into the complexities, but can you give us a bird's eye view of what has changed over the last couple decades?
Sure. So my book is looking at contemporary marriage patterns in conjunction with popular women's media. And so what I started finding when I began researching this book was that marriage is increasingly conferring a number of status of rewards to women and economic rewards. Now, marriage has always been something of an economic institution, but the way we talk about marriage, I think, in the past 40 or so years has really elided that conversation of economics. We tend to think about love and romance and intimacy. But more and more, I think the economics of marriage are reemerging on the national scene. When we think about the fact that college-educated women are more likely to be married, when we think about the fact that getting married is in some ways the best thing you can do to ensure your financial future, what I'm seeing is a much more of a kind of hard-eyed, clear-eyed view of marriage as an economic partnership as much as it is a romantic and intimate arrangement.
One of the first examples you give in your book is this letter to women at Princeton. Mm-hmm. Can you go into the complexities of what was said to these college students at Princeton?
Sure, right. So Susan Patton, a graduate of Princeton, wrote a letter about 5 years ago she addressed it to the daughters I never had. And she basically said, you are some of the smartest, most well-educated women in the country. And if you have hopes of finding a husband, the best place to find them is here at Princeton. When she says, you are basically surrounded by men who are worthy of you. And she says, you're never again going to be surrounded by that kind of concentration of men who are smart and, frankly, have the potential to be high earning. So she encourages women who want to get married as soon as they can. In other words, to find somebody at Princeton. And she really puts this in very explicit market terms. She says, when you're a freshman, you have 4 years of men to choose from. And by the time you're a senior, those men are going to be looking for younger women. So she's a very, in my opinion, rigid conception of the marketplace, of the marriage marketplace. And the fact that there's a lot of pressures on women to find men, in that case, who are, in her words, worthy of them, and that it was really the onus and the responsibility of those women hoping to marry well to find men who were kind of their intellectual and economic equivalents. And so, and it got a lot of press, I think.
What was the backlash? What were the consequences of that letter?
Yes. So I think there were some people who thought, well, gee, women going to Princeton are not necessarily looking for a husband, right? I mean, there's this kind of age-old joke about the MRS degree, right? So that women go to college looking for, co-ed colleges anyway, looking for a spouse. And that had seemed so antiquated. So in some ways, people thought, my goodness, you know, this is a really old-fashioned way of looking at relationships, of marriage, particularly of Ivy League educated women. But I think her advice really struck a chord because it was given in conjunction with the time kind of post-recession in the American economy where there was this sense that earning power, particularly for men, there was a lot of discussion about men's reduced earning power post-recession. You know, books like The End of Men, thinking about, again, men's inability to sort of be providers in that way, that I think really introduced this idea of a scarcity economy into the conversation. And though she did get a lot of backlash, there was actually quite a lot of support for what she said. People thought, you know, that makes sense. It is a tight market. And you probably, you know, you are surrounded by a concentration of you know, high earners in a way you may never be again. So, you know, she got a book contract with Simon & Schuster. I mean, this is a 600-word letter that she wrote in the Princetonian, and she got a book contract. So I think that tells you something about the resonance of that message.
Well, in this time period, too, we're seeing the lean-in movement. Sheryl Sandberg over at Facebook, her book is coming into the fore as well, and women are seeing a lot of different messages about their place in the workplace versus their place at home and the push-pull of that. How does that factor in that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's funny because Susan Patton explicitly cites lean in. She says, I don't care whether you lean in or you lean out, but I've got some advice for you. But kind of more interesting for my purposes is one of the things that Sheryl Sandberg says in her early chapters is one of the most important decisions a woman will make about her career is who she marries. And she talks about finding a supportive partner, finding a partner that's going to be willing to nurture a woman's own ambitions. And so Sheryl Sandberg, as much as her book was about a professional trajectory for women and professional accomplishment, she very much yoked that to their personal lives, which is a conversation, of course, that popular culture often does, right? It's almost impossible to talk about women's professional accomplishments without talking about the commensurate personal lives. So I think the fact that Sheryl Sandberg did that early in her book and made that a priority really speaks to the fact that you can't divorce the kind of economics and the careers from the personal lives.
Yeah, literally or figuratively. Talking with Suzanne Leonard right now. The book is Wife, Inc., The Business of Marriage in the 21st Century. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen marriage change, evolve over the decades? What do you think it means to be a wife these days? Have you seen the expectations change? What kind of messages are you seeing from pop culture sending women about marriage and being a wife? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Suzanne, a traditional heterosexual marriage is a partnership, one man, one woman. And while marriage has really evolved for both, your book mainly explores how it's changed for the wives. And that change, you say, has been really significant. What do you see has been the biggest shift or change as you see it?
I think this expectation that women who desire marriage need to labor on behalf of succeeding and finding a marriageable partner. You know, I think, and again, popular culture and women's popular culture is really the field that I study. So I'm thinking about the messages that it sends to women. And frankly, popular culture has always been very concerned with women making themselves marriageable, right? What I see is slightly different is the intensity and the ratcheting up of the expectations for the work, the labor, the money, that and even the kind of emotional management that women have to undertake in order to make themselves marriageable. So one of the chapters of my book looks at online dating, and I read a lot of advice tracks about how to make oneself attractive in online dating spheres. And just what I found is that the advice is atomized to the point of, you know, how many pictures you should have on your profile, the kind of emotions you're supposed to have, the kind of aspirations for your life you're supposed to perform.
The specific words you're supposed to use, like avoiding what, you know, certain words, or there was something about avocado recently. I can't remember.
Oh.
Yeah. What was it? I don't know. That just calls to mind. But, you know, some very specific tips.
Very specific tips. I mean, one of the things that stands out of my mind is red makes you clickable. Like, you know, wear red. And I mean, and not only that, but be eternally optimistic, be easygoing, be flexible. Don't reveal that you're too ambitious. And also, and I think a real subtext of a lot of this conversation is know your value. So know your value in this marketplace, this dating marketplace. You know what you're looking for and kind of know what you can get. So, you know, and people, I think, are starting to even think of themselves in these ways, right, as these sort of brands and, okay, what is my brand value? And that concept of branding that has I think, permeated much of our lives these days, has also permeated sort of the dating world.
Author Suzanne Leonard writes that the housewife is a convenient straw figure in 21st century American media. Her book is Wife Inc. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen marriage change over the past couple decades? What do you think it means to be a wife? Have you seen expectations change? Have you decided to opt out, so to speak, of marriage, avoid it altogether? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update right here on the Ideas Network. The former top aide to Hillary Clinton, Huma Abedin, talked to Vogue this month about forging a close friendship with fashion designer Georgina Chapman, who is divorced from disgraced Hollywood filmmaker Harvey Weinstein. Abedin said the two of them are part of a club of women whom, quote, people don't feel sorry for. We're talking about the book Wife Inc. here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Abedin went on to say that this particular club, ironically, it's not such a small one. Women who have to endure it in such a, quote, public way. Author Suzanne Leonard stays with us for this discussion on what it is to be a wife in the 21st century. Getting your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. What kinds of messages is pop culture sending women about marriage and being a wife? Have you seen expectations change? In what way? You can join in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Suzanne, I want to talk for a moment about women in marriages where a man has fallen. It has been disgraced, perhaps has gone to prison. We see here Huma Abedin, who has talked openly about this, and she also appears in your book.
Yes, and one of the things that I found when I started looking at the kind of playbook for the scorned wife is that script has really changed. And I sort of would credit this to the post-Spitzer affair, when you had kind of his wife kind of standing by him. Elliot Spitzer, excuse me. His wife sort of standing by him silently, and then suddenly we had the show The Good Wife, right, where we suddenly kind of personify the side of the wife, and she gets to tell her story. And that, I think that vehicle and that openness and that desire to sort of hear from the wife really inaugurated a whole host of not just television texts, but some scorned wives have wrote memoirs. I'm thinking of Jenny Sanford's memoir, Staying True, ex-wife of Congressman Mark Sanford, or ex-governor Mark Sanford. And so there really was a new cultural openness, I think, for women to talk about their betrayals, and to also, I think, talk about the work of wifedom, which is, again, the topic of my book, but the way in which they felt betrayed, because a lot of the work they had done was also on behalf of their husband's campaign, keeping a certain image of their marriage, which then helped make him electable. And a lot of those, some, not all, but some have gone on to forge careers of their own. And there's been a lot of speculation. Obviously, Huma Abedin, had Hillary Clinton been elected, it was widely reported she would have been tapped to be the chief of staff. The narrative has shifted a bit. It's not just the scorned wife, but the scorned wife with her own set of goals and ambitions and desires.
It's also part of the business, because in the man's role there, in these particular instances, it's been about the job and it's been about the pursuit of power. And we often see these, it's like a press conference, the man's behind the podium and there is the wife next to him looking down, and there's a story there.
And there's a story there. And that's exactly, I think, what the creators of The Good Wife saw, right? That there was a story there. And that in some ways, that was the more interesting story, right? The story of the wife and how she negotiated that, and how she negotiated suddenly being thrust into the limelight when she might not have desired that kind of that sort of attention. And certainly that was Uma Abedin's story. Although, you know, I do think that Uma Abedin's status as a fashion icon is also really interesting to bring into play here, because there's not just her own political career, but also the fact that she, you know, regularly appears in Vogue. She sort of has her own business in some ways as a fashion icon and celebrity in her own right as well.
Well, let's look a little bit more at the TV offerings that are out there that involve marriage. You got The Bachelor, that's a staple. Say Yes to the Dress, Bridezillas, just to name a few. But beyond that, there are a ton of shows that focus on some kind of wives. You look a lot at Desperate Housewives. There's a lot out there. So what is going on in terms of these shows sending particular messages and about what it means to be a wife?
I think I would put the shows that you just mentioned into sort of two camps. There's the kind of looking for marriage shows like The Bachelor, where people are being trained on, or I look at something in the book called Shedding for the Wedding, right? And so it's all about kind of getting fit for your wedding. Even Say Yes to the Dress is about finding the dress that's going to, you know, sort of inaugurate you as the perfect bride, right? It's going to make you look as good as possible. So I think that's one realm of kind of wedding programming. But then there's this whole other realm of wifely programming, right? Shows about wives. And what I've come to find is shows about wives are really just shows about women. They're actually just shows to talk about the concerns, issues, tensions in women's lives. For example, the Real Housewives, Bravo's franchise, is much more about the friendships, frankly, between those women. It has often very little to do with their actual lives as wives and mothers, and more to do with their existences kind of navigating female communities. So the term wife, I think, has really become a catch-all just to talk about anything that popular culture deems interesting to women.
You also say that the housewife and the workplace, the person who's in the workplace, that they pit those against each other, like you say, a catfight. How is that working there?
Yeah, I mean, this feels like an age-old fight, right? I think in part because the housewife had for a long time been a figure that had kind of been rejected. Particularly, I think there was a moment in the 1970s where the figure of the housewife became the kind of person that the enlightened, ambitious career woman did not want to be. Right. And so there was this tension, I think, from that point on in kind of American culture, where the housewife was sort of disavowed. But then she always sort of existed in the shadows. And then kind of, and I sort of date this to Desperate Housewives, suddenly she was back. Right, she was back in this kind of ironic way. You also get people claiming, "Well, I want to be a housewife, and it's too much pressure to try to have a family and have a career." And so suddenly, the housewife comes back as something that maybe it's like a guilty desire, right? So mm-hmm. The ambitious woman going to an Ivy League school really just wants to be a housewife, and she kind of admits this in hushed tones. But I have to feel that popular culture has given us a very limited framing for this debate, right? You can either be the housewife or you can be the career woman, and sort of there's this expectation that never the twain shall meet. And I think that's really a misnomer, but it's a very convenient story for popular culture to narrate for us.
We've heard a lot in recent years about the so-called decline in marriage, that people are increasingly opting out for whatever the reason. Do the numbers back that up?
Well, you know, they do and they don't. For college-educated women, marriage numbers are remaining quite high, actually. It's for people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, people who might not have college educations. Their marriage numbers are in decline. So looking at marriage rates is actually a way, or looking at that those different numbers is actually a way to track income inequality in this country, because people that have means and are of means are continuing to marry in very respectable numbers. And there's, and as I was sort of saying earlier in our conversation, there's a lot of research that's been tied to the idea that getting married is one of the best things you can do for your financial future. You know, Glamour magazine a couple months ago literally had a story about wealth and women, and it said the best thing you can do for your financial well-being in the future is to get married and stay happily married. So I think it's a bit overstated to say no one's getting married anymore.
Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, what I see changing, you know, from my parents' generation to our generation with marriages, and really a society issue as a whole, is just the thought that men are disposable, that men's roles are still supposed to be a provider, yet as women enter the workforce, which is a great thing, there's a lot of community atmosphere when it comes to women. There's a lot of women helping women, networking groups, and pushing a woman's rights agenda. There's nothing really there for men, and I think men by nature are more isolationist. They don't develop support groups the same way as women do, and I think it's having a significant impact. If you look at suicide rates of men over 40, it's one of the highest growth areas of suicide. So I think the medical field is more geared towards women. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot of changes even the next 50 years in terms of what men's roles and how they're going to deal with what their roles ultimately should be or will be.
Steve, thanks for bringing these insights to the table. Suzanne, what do you make of that?
You know, I think there's something really interesting what Steve said about the lack of support culture for men. And I'm just thinking, again, I study popular culture, and I'm thinking about the fact that there are quite a few representations of female communities. Now, often they're marked by some acrimony, and there's a lot of tension and fighting. But it does strike me in what Steve is saying that there are very few representations in American popular media of men supporting other men in kind of productive and compassionate ways. So that does strike me as a bit of an impoverishment in some of the popular culture that we see.
Let's bring in Liz now, joining us from Cottage Grove. Hi, Liz.
Hi, good morning. Interesting topic. I just wondered what your guests thought about the new generation coming up. It seemed to me that they have more of an equal distribution of labor in the household. Myself, I was a traditional stay-at-home mom until I got divorced, and I found the views in the court viewed women as property and expected us to kind of walk away without an equal distribution, even though that's what the law said in Wisconsin, that it was community property. So giving up your career at the highest income earning years in your life to raise children cannot be an economic win for some women if the marriage crumbles. So I see some people in this new generation continuing to work, and the fathers actually do more of the household labor so that the women can work.
Well, a lot there, Liz. Suzanne, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's been a lot more attention paid to the simple labor of running a house, right? And a lot more attention paid to the idea that, boy, it's hard to do the dishes and make beds and cook food and do laundry, and that there's no way for this to function if you don't have kind of equal help there. But it's interesting what your caller says about if a marriage does not work, right? And again, I'm thinking of this Glamour article that I referenced earlier. It's very careful to say, you know, the best thing a woman can do for her financial future is not only to get married, but to stay happily married. And as soon as a partnership breaks up, a lot of those financial benefits of marriage crumble as well. So that's, I think, a very acute point.
One of the most popular stories in The Atlantic this year was a piece by Andrew Cherlin titled "Marriage Has Become a Trophy." In it, he argues that a wedding is no longer the first step into adulthood that it once was, but often the last. What do you make of that assessment?
Yes, actually, Cherlin's work has been somewhat influential in my own, particularly his idea that Marriage is something like a luxury item or a status item to show that you've achieved the kind of last mark of adulthood and success. And so I would really, I would agree with what he's saying in that particular way. But I also think that there is something, at least it's not in that particular Atlantic article, which is the way in which people assess each other's kind of financial futures when they're deciding whether to get married. So that that the calculation about yoking your financial future to somebody else is something that people are making. They might not realize they're making it, but that, you know, again, a lot of the populations that Cherilyn is talking about who do get married later are college educated, right? Mm. And he even goes out to say marriage is a much more central part of family life among the college educated. So once again, I think the people that he's talking about that are getting married late in life and using marriage as a sort of topper on their life are a particular elite group in some ways.
So for women who are opting out of marriage, what do we know about these women?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it depends at what point we talk about women opting out, mm-hmm. right? You know, when I was doing the research for the book, I came across a Cosmopolitan article which was sort of talking about the increasing popularity of opting out, and clearly that's a population or a magazine that's geared towards 20-somethings and 30-somethings. So I think those women may end up opting in their 40s or 50s, right? So, so I think it's a difficult thing, like when you've declared you've opted out, exactly like at what age kind of that is. But what I do think is happening though is that because again, women and work and financial security has become such a popular conversation, women don't necessarily feel the pressure to marry young in ways that they did, you know, I think in my own parents' generation, for example.
Yeah. And opting in, you say, in 40s and 50s, that's interesting because that's past childbearing years. Mm. And so that takes out that element.
It does. Yeah, it does.
For the most part.
I mean, I think women in this kind of elite high status category are opting to have children on their own, right? So that's another thing that's happening. They may be opting out of marriage, but opting out of marriage these days doesn't necessarily mean opting out of motherhood. So I think that's also another just data point.
And in 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court paved the way for legal same-sex marriage in all 50 states. So we're wondering how the nationwide adoption of same-sex marriage factors into all of this conversation, all of what you study. Has that had an impact on how we view traditional marriage?
Yeah, you know, when I was in the course of writing this book when that when the Supreme Court case passed, and you know, I was actually surprised in some ways how little things changed. Right. In fact, the wedding industry is a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry. I don't even know. And in a way, it was very hospitable. Many places, anyway, were very hospitable to the notion that okay, we have a whole other market to sell wedding dresses and cakes and venues and flowers to. So you know, weddings continue to be a big business, and they continue. And in some ways, now they're an even bigger business, right? Because they're open to swathes of the population that they weren't open to before. So, you know, I think that certainly think something has changed, but I don't know that it's fundamentally shaken any of the foundations that I'm kind of diagnosing in this book.
Author Suzanne Leonard writes that marriage is a choice, and increasingly women and men are opting out. We're exploring the role of marriage in the 21st century, the complicated world of being, quote, a wife. You're with us on The Morning Show. The book is Wife, Inc., getting your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Have you seen marriage change over the decades? What role do shows like The Bachelor and Desperate Housewives and The Good Wife have to do with how you perceive the image of what wife is? You can call in 800-642-1234, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this news update here on the Ideas Network. The Real Housewives of your location du jour, New York, Orange County. You fill in the blank. That Bravo franchise premiered a decade ago, and this New York edition features several confident women who change throughout the seasons as the women leave, with some returning later on. The featured ladies over time have included entrepreneur and one-time talk show host Bethany Frankel, who is explored in the new book, Wife, Inc. Author Suzanne Leonard is our guide through the complexities of marriage and being a wife in the 21st century. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The floor is yours. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it means to be a wife? Have you seen expectations evolve? Do you have priorities as you look ahead to marriage? You can call in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to Stephen now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Doing well. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think at least in my generation, I'm 25, I think a big part of it is economically, it doesn't make sense for a lot of people my age to do the whole getting married, spend money on a big wedding kind of thing. On top of that, when I grew up, that's kind of when we saw this boom in divorce rates. So I think there's a lot of hesitation going into big weddings, at least for people my age. So I just, that's kind of more of a commentary thing, and I didn't know if that was a trend that agreed, if there was a trend that agreed with that.
Do you intend to get married someday?
Yes, I do, hopefully, but I think there's a lot more questions now than there used to be.
Suzanne, what do you make of that?
Yeah, thank you so much for that honest account, because I think, yes, to just validate your experiences, Stephen, that's what we're hearing a lot from young people saying, you know, I might be saddled with student debt. I'm a little wary of relationships. So there's a lot more accounting that's kind of going into that decision. And another thing that's happening is marriage, rates of first marriage are steadily climbing. I think they're around maybe 27 for women now and 29 for men, and those have been steadily climbing over the past 50 years. So I think, Stephen, your experiences are well validated demographically, and there's a lot of people who feel very similar.
And it's interesting, too, the economics at play here. I mean, he's saying, look, a big wedding, that's wasteful spending.
Exactly. And not money, you know, that a lot of people have access to at young ages specifically.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Suzanne, let's go back a moment here and look at The Real Housewives and what's going on there. You write about Bethany Frankel, who is the person behind the Skinny Girl franchise. What are some of the points you're trying to make through Frankel's lens?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I want to argue about Frankel is she, in a sense, figured out how to brand being a kind of single girl in the city and then brand being a wife and became a multimillionaire by doing it, right? So when she first appeared on The Real Housewives of New York, she was single, she was living in the city, she was looking for a partner, she was also trying to market this or start a business, right? And then she really took off, earned herself a spinoff show when she also got pregnant and got married. And you know, what I think she figured out a way to do was to, in a sense, give her public access to kind of all the narratives about femininity and womanhood that interest a lot of audiences. How do you find a partner? How do you navigate new parenthood? How do you build a business? What do you do when you make more money than your husband, which was a point of contention in their marriage? So I think in some ways, part of her success was sort of narrating the struggles and tensions that a lot of young, upwardly mobile women face, right? And doing that in a very public and a very confessional way, and having done that really paid dividends for her economically.
What do we see out of this Real Housewives franchise today? Are the storylines the same as they were a decade ago when it launched?
You know, I'm sorry to say no. I mean, when it launched a decade ago, it was a much more, I think, ethnographic story just about these women and their lives. And now I would argue that it's really become a platform for a lot of these women to launch brands, right? Ah. Makeup brands and fashion and accessories, purses. And people often go on the show with that intention. It's also become, I think, in a way to showcase some of the uglier aspects of female relationships, which is something that really saddens me because in its early years, the show wasn't so much about the fighting, right? So in some ways, I think sometimes these shows confirm our worst stereotypes about women, and that saddens me.
And do those stereotypes then permeate into real life for everyday, you know, Americans?
I think so. You know, when we think about, you know, to kind of double back in our conversation about ambition, you know, I think female ambition is still something that is very ugly to a lot of people, right? And I think part of that, what that show does is it makes female ambition seem ugly, and it makes it seem competitive and catty. And again, that troubles me, you know, as someone who feels that female relationships can be supportive and compassionate. So I think that in some ways I do think that these representations can do real harm because they confirm our worst fears in some ways.
How has social media changed the landscape for what it means to be a wife?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. And this is something that is not just the kind of celebrities who appear on The Real Housewives need to do. But I think so many people feel the need to curate their lives via social media. And often what is getting curated are their family photos, their family vacations, their weddings, the pictures of their new baby. And I too spend a lot of time like thinking about how I'm going to curate my social media presence and kind of perform being a wife or perform being a mother. And I do think that that is something that has really changed in the way that people think about how, not just how they experience their life, but then how they want to show that life to their family and friends and coworkers and people they went to high school with. So I do think social media has added an extra layer of labor, which is something, again, I talk quite a bit about in the book.
Well, there is this labor that you keep talking about, but what is this labor like? What is this behind this labor to the altar or to marriage?
I mean, I think that it takes a number of forms. One is, as I was saying, the labor of trying to get oneself ready to marry and look a certain way and then maintain, right? Maintain that kind of look, maintain that sort of status. So there's a lot of labor in that. There's the labor of, as I was talking about with social media, of the pressure, I think, the pressure to sort of have a certain look and curated life that then says to others, hey, I'm very successful, right? And then there's the simple labor of relationship management, right, which I think we don't talk very much about, but that is laborious and child-rearing and all of that. So I think it's taking place in a number of different registers.
As we look to the future of marriage, what do you see as the biggest question marks out there going forward?
You know, I'm going to take it actually back to Stephen, our caller Stephen, who we just heard from. I think one of the biggest question marks is, will people who don't feel economically ready to marry in their 20s feel more secure in their 30s and 40s, or will they never feel secure enough to marry? And I think, to me, that's one of the unanswered questions, one of the open questions here, because I do think we're in a moment where a large swathes of the population feel that getting married is just, again, frankly, too expensive. and so I think that that's my big question about, will that trend continue? And then will we continue to see smaller and smaller numbers of people getting married? Will it continue to be just a luxury item only available to the very rich and well-off?
Yeah, and it's interesting, and you're breaking up just a little bit. I hope we can get a little bit better phone reception here. But it's almost as if we're looking so much exclusively here during this conversation about the money aspect of marriage, the economic implications of marriage. What about the love? Where has love gone?
Yeah, where has it gone? I think it's still there. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that people don't enter into relationships for the same reasons that they always did. But I do think the economic pressures have become a little bit more transparent than they were in times when people felt a little bit more economically secure. I think the love, the intimacy is all the romance. It still exists. It still exists for many people. But I think that people are much more aware and savvy about the economics of marriage. And that's, I think, what I believe has changed.
We just had an email come in from Alex who says, I'm a single man, and while I grew up always assuming I would marry, as time went on, I gradually came to regard marriage as something that degrades a woman's life. How would you respond to Alex?
Wow, that's so profound. You know, I think this is such an individual question for so many people. I would say that I'd be curious to hear from Alex how he came to that realization, because I would say I think what popular culture teaches is that women should continue to aspire to marriage, and that weddings and the spectacle of weddings and marriage are sort of the pinnacle of existence. So I think. Again, it's hard to know, given that I don't know this person's background. But I do think that there's just a lot more thought and attention being paid to what this means for people's individual lives. And the expectation isn't rote. People, as we've heard from a number of callers now, not everybody thinks they're going to get married. And there are various reasons why that is. But I think that's a good thing, that this is an open question now in ways that perhaps it wasn't 30 or 40 years ago.
Suzanne, as we wrap up here, do you think marriage as we know it will always exist, or do you see a scenario where an end might be in sight?
I think it will always exist. I think the way in which marriage bundles, again, all of the kind of soft things we've been talking about, the romance, but it bundles it to a host of rights and privileges, right? And that's pretty attractive.
Suzanne, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Suzanne Leonard is Associate Professor of English at Simmons College in Boston, and her new book is Wife, Inc., The Business of Marriage in the 21st Century. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and the Ideas Network Director Cheryl Gasser. Michael Derringer provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation about marriage, you find it on the Ideas Network.